It's time for Open Journal's Community Spotlight, where listeners like you produce your own program. This airtime is a free service offered to those interested in sharing their knowledge, talent, and passions. This is also a space to audition new programming. Opinions expressed in Open Journal may not reflect the views of the Pacifica Foundation, its staff, board, or volunteers. Information shared on Open Journal should not take the place of appropriate professional consultation. Now it's time for Open Journal's Community Spotlight here on KPFT Houston.
Hi, and welcome to Open Journal. This is Mike Honig, and I call my show Think Wing Radio. Today's topic, I think, is something that we need to talk about that isn't being discussed much. For at least a decade, the United States has engaged in covert and clandestine operations using highly skilled warriors, advanced technology to attack individuals and installations around the world in order to protect American interests and security. In North and East Africa, Southwest and South Asia, and Latin America, we've conducted offensive operations without a declaration of war, often with the knowledge or cooperation of the nations in question, but sometimes not. Unmanned drone aircraft are a big part of this deployed capability, but not the only part. And these military actions are part of a greater, what I'm calling, anarchy of belligerence, which has been developing since 1942. Let's imagine a scenario. It's sometime in the future. A neighboring country is facing a bloody militant insurgency. Revolutionaries have found a sanctuary across the border in the U.S. in a thinly populated, rugged area where access and observation are challenging. The U.S. government, in this case, has been unable or unwilling to clear out this rebel base, so our neighbor takes matters into its own hands. Using human intelligence and infrared technology, they send an armed stealth drone across the U.S. border and attack the rebel base. The damage is severe. Many rebels have been killed, possibly along with some U.S. civilians. What will be Washington's reaction? To congratulate that government on their great military success, or to condemn them for attacking U.S. soil and perhaps begin a retaliatory response? And international cooperation aside, what will be the public reaction to a foreign attack on American soil? Something like this, somewhere in the world, maybe here someday, is not only the future, it's the present. What will be our response when it eventually happens on our soil? What military precedents have we set in our own perceived defense, which will come back to haunt us? And how will we be able to unhypocritically argue against them? In other words, the U.S. has set the precedents. What will we do when the shoe is on the other foot? My guest today is D.B. David Grady. He's an essayist, novelist, and correspondent for The Atlantic, also a former paratrooper with U.S. Army Special Operations Command, and a veteran of Afghanistan. He is currently co-authoring an examination of the secrecy apparatus of the United States government with co-author Mark Ambinder, and it will be published by John Wiley & Sons sometime this year. How you doing, David?
Doing very well. How are you?
Fine, thanks. So, we've talked a little about this in advance, and I guess the notion that I have is we are sort of in this anarchic phase of international military relations. We no longer have the niceties of diplomats delivering declarations of war to avoid sneak attacks and all of these other little diplomatic rituals that had developed for, I guess, at least several hundred years. And the U.S. now does what it does. I believe because we feel the need, we have the capability, we do it essentially because we can. What's going to happen when other countries can?
That's a very, obviously it's a very interesting question, and it's kind of a reverse Pakistan situation, what we're facing right now in that region. The big question, of course, is, as you mentioned, how do we respond when, for example, a drone aircraft, which obviously that type of technology will proliferate across around the world in due course. What happens when a drone aircraft is flying over U.S. soil? Already we have satellites from foreign powers, but satellites aren't quite so dangerous or quite so startling as low-flying or high-flying aircraft that are monitoring U.S. civilians and U.S. citizens.
Well, a comment you've made is, what do we do when we face our U-2 moment?
Exactly. The big question is, what happens if one of those drone aircraft crash, for example, in, say, Syracuse, New York, and even worse, what happens if people die? Suddenly it goes from being an abstract question to a very serious problem, and moves from the realm of simple covert operations, the kind of thing that we talk about abstractly, and it becomes almost a warlike situation. And it's something that's probably not discussed enough. The entire, you may want to call it the secret war between shadow superpowers, goes on every day. Sunlight is by far overdue in order to prevent what could be an accident from turning into a catastrophe.
I think one of the questions that has been fundamentally concerning me is, we are moving into a new type of diplomatic age. And my concern is, are we simply going to wing it and get there by the seat of our pants and, to paraphrase an old saying, let chaos ensue? Or are we going to manage this from our current preeminent diplomatic, military, economic position? Economic may not be lasting that much longer. And try to manage this transition in a lawful way. I think, you know, with all the flaws the United States has, I think that for the most part, over the last 200 some years, the United States, especially because of its weak position early on, has been very much a proponent of international law, developing international multilateral treaties to control what is considered acceptable international behavior. And I'm afraid that in the last 10 or so years, we have probably done more to degrade that system than any other country in the world. And unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, the world mirrors us. What we do becomes acceptable. And by the way, I'm going to mention that it is KPFT Houston 90.1 FM, just in case you hadn't noticed. Do you have any comments on that, David?
You know, it's very interesting. Post 9/11, obviously a new type of order was going to take hold in U.S. foreign policy. And there was a lot of great expectations with the election of President Obama that these types of things would be brought into the system, and there would be some degree of transparency and some accountability to, you know, the types of operations we're presently engaged in. And interestingly, the exact opposite happened. President Obama has actually stepped up the types of black operations that we're talking about now to a degree that is almost breathtaking in scope. I believe we're presently operating military forces in 50-some-odd countries around the world. And we're not just talking about places like Somalia, but we're talking about places like, I mean, fairly successful nations in South America conducting those types of operations. Now, one of the ways that we are conducting this is obviously it's done in secret, but it's done above the board with most of these countries. We let their states know, we're coming in, how do you want to handle this? And for the most part, they've been very cooperative. But there are instances like Pakistan where there is no advance notice. We just come in and do what we need to do. And we've been doing that for quite some time.
And I don't think either of us is necessarily saying this is always okay or this is always wrong. I think, again, the word I would use is the anarchy of the situational decision-making, the fact that there are no guidelines for this. This is basically untrod ground, and we need, I think at some point, nations need to get together and try to codify when these kinds of things are acceptable. I think in some ways I understand why we don't declare war anymore. Really, it's because our technology has outpaced our communications to the point where you can have boots on the ground before they open the telegram. I understand the reasons for some of these things to an extent, but that doesn't negate the need for some new process.
Right. Obviously, along the lines of what you said, always okay or always wrong. Here's what's interesting, and here's kind of a thought experiment that one could engage in. If you look at what's going on today with our drone aircraft, and we'll just use the obvious example of our drone aircraft over Iran, over Pakistan, over Afghanistan, and Iraq, and just that general region. Obviously, as we are in states, military conflict with those countries, or at least the two primary countries, it's not so much a it's not so much a hard thing to consider. But how long are we going to maintain these operations with no formal mechanism, no formal set of rules, no formal or at least no known set of rules for when we engage in these types of operations? Because you know, the conditions under which we begin drone operations over a country are secret. I mean, they're the secret, most secret of secrets. The problem is, how long are we going to do this? Are we going to do this for 5 years? Are we going to do this for 10 years? Are we going to do this for 100 years? At what point do these countries become reliant? Because in some cases, when we drop a, when we send a Hellfire missile down on a terrorist training camp, we're doing these host countries a favor. The people in Yemen are very happy to have an Al-Qaeda cell eliminated. At what point do these countries become dependent upon the United States being, to not use a better phrase, being world police? We're establishing ourselves in a permanent military presence around the world in a way that I don't think people are really paying close attention to.
Well, I think that to some extent that begins to tie into conversations you and I have had about the fact that an all-volunteer force takes a lot of the political pain out of committing forces around the world. And I think getting back to the drone situation and stealth units like SEAL Team 6, I think it just makes it really, really easy to insert these kinds of forces or weapons without having to pay a political price. In the case of an unmanned drone, you don't even have to worry about a pilot being killed or captured, you know, so the political risk is relatively low.
That's right. And Mark Bowden, and he wrote, obviously, several years ago in the book Black Hawk Down, that such units as Delta and, of course, SEAL Team 6, generally units under the United States Joint Special Operations Command, they allow politicians to have it both ways, to not get involved, yet at the same time directly engage in military confrontations with certain nation states or certain elements of those states. And since the 1980s, we've been engaged in operations around the world doing these sorts of assassination missions and things like that. Only now are we really beginning to start paying attention to it, and JSOC is beginning to come into focus as something that we probably need to pay a little closer attention to. Not that it's a rogue elephant, to use a phrase from the church hearings, but
simply because, Frank Church.
Right. Yeah. Simply because we're very dependent upon JSOC now. We need them, but at the same time, under when do we need them? Why do we need them? When do we use them? Just basic questions need to be answered in order for us to, just as a functioning democracy.
Again, it needs to be in some form codified.
Exactly. There needs to be some understanding between the American people and the government.
Yeah, we've gotten into a serious disconnect between civil military and the public. We are going to be taking a break in a moment, and I want to put out the caller number. We will take a couple of phone calls if anyone out there has anything they would like to comment on this topic. The call-in number is 713-526-5738 or 713-526-KPFT. Or, as Dwayne said earlier, 713-Jackson-6-KPFT, if you're old school, as he put it. I am very old school. We are going to take a break now, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio, KPFT Houston. The time is coming up on 9:44. Here's a quick look at traffic and weather. The accidents mentioned earlier have been cleared. There is some slow traffic left. That's on 610 West Loop, southbound from I-10, Katy Freeway to Westheimer. The travel time is 6.5 minutes. And if you're on 45 Gulf Freeway, northbound from El Dorado to Fuquay, travel time 7 minutes. And on 290 Northwest Freeway, inbound from Pinemont to West 34th, is currently just a little over 5 minutes. And the temperature is 51 degrees with a few clouds. Humidity is 64%. Today's forecast for Harris County, sunny with a high of 69 degrees and a low of 41 degrees. Air quality is in the good range. Please stay tuned after today's community spotlight for the 420 Drug War News, followed by Undercurrents at 10 o'clock and then Wide Open Spaces at 11 o'clock. And now back to the community spotlight. Today's program is Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig.
Hi, this is Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig, and I am he. And the topic we're basically talking about, I've summed up as, is it time for a new world order for making war and peace? You know, you had mentioned David, and my guest, by the way, is David D.B. Grady, whom I call David, of The Atlantic. You had made a comment earlier referring to assassination, and that's actually a point that I think is timely, given the fact that apparently within the last few hours, an Iranian atomic scientist was assassinated using what's called a magnet bomb, which a motorcycle rider stuck to his car, which then pretty much instantly exploded. And, you know, this is another one of those gray areas. We don't know who did it. We don't know if it was Israel. We don't know if it was the United States, or it could have been any other power, any Western power, even some of the Middle Eastern powers. Where does that figure in? Is this just old-fashioned spycraft, or does assassination cross a new line in terms of these kinds of operations?
It's not particularly new. I mean, this is the kind of thing, say, in the 1980s when some drug lord in South America would mysteriously turn up dead. Why, what a happy coincidence. Now they're gone.
Happy.
So I don't know that anyone in the intelligence community in the United States today is saying, gosh, it's a real loss for this.
I'm not saying there's a lot of crying going on. Really what I'm looking at, I'm sort of looking at the technicality of it.
Right. There's almost zero chance that there will ever be a change in United States policy with regard to this type of thing. Of course, the CIA is forbidden, or was forbidden, I'm certain that the law has been changed for that, from engaging in overt assassination policies.
Overt being the key word.
And so far as I know that during the Church Commission hearings, there was a huge investigation into the activities of the intelligence community, and they found... And they looked, believe me, this also applies to the Rockefeller Commission hearings. The CIA had never successfully committed an assassination. Obviously, the rules would have changed after 9/11, and unfortunately, I don't have the laws handy.
And we've kind of gone beyond fatally exploding cigars a la Castro. I have Sharon on the line, and Sharon, you're on the air. What do you think of the conversation we're having?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Wonderful. I want to ask a question. How serious is it that Iran has one of our drones? And that's all I need to know. Thank you.
Good question. David, do you have any thoughts on that?
Obviously, it's it's a setback for the United States in that we don't want them to have our technology. But the advantages are the, I don't want to say the advantages, but the realistic situation is stealth technology isn't particularly, it's not a new thing. It's been around for a while, and most countries, I would expect, including Iran, have stealth technology. Unmanned aerial vehicles aren't in and of themselves particularly difficult technology, so that's not all that scary. The real question is what technology was on the drone, because these things, they're not one-size-fits-all. They're very modular, so you can install, say, nuclear scanning capabilities, or you can take that off and put in capabilities to, say, spy on particular people, or you can put in weapon systems. So the question is, what systems were on the drone at the time, and are they sufficiently encrypted where they're essentially paperweights? That's kind of the big question. That's something that we're probably never going to have an answer to. I wouldn't say that it's going to be a catastrophe for the United States. It's just unfortunate. And in this kind of thing, this is what we see in the intelligence operations around the world. Whenever a spy is caught, everybody kind of puts on a show and stumps around on the stage and says, how dare the United States spy on us, or how dare Israel, or how dare Iran, or whatever country, how dare they spy on us? And then it just kind of fades from the news. And this is one of those situations where Iran gets to have a couple of weeks where they say, how dare the United States do this? And in a couple of weeks, we're going to be right back at it.
Technological implications for the long term? Do you think anything potentially serious was lost? Because the Republicans in Congress sure made it sound like this was a national security disaster.
Well, I wouldn't call it a national security disaster. I mean, you have to maintain a certain level of level-headedness there. 9/11 was a national security disaster. This is more like a national security unfortunate incident, kind of like the downed Black Hawk on the Osama bin Laden raid.
Right.
It's not going to set back the intelligence community of the United States or our operations. It's just something that we would have preferred not happen.
I seem to be at a loss for words for the moment. Well, let me do this. Listener call-in number, if anyone else has any comments or questions, is 713-526-5738, 713-526-5738. So what do you think is going to be the future? Other countries are going to establish this technology. You know, there's the old Reagan thing. I don't quote Reagan a lot, but one of my favorites is trust but verify. You know, it's like the old story that the police give you. If you're innocent, what do you have to hide? There is a peacekeeping aspect to the ability to surveil without having to actually use armed military aircraft. Manned armed military aircraft.
That's right. And I would like to make a distinction, obviously, between unmanned aerial vehicles that are simply engaged in spy missions or surveillance operations versus armed predator drones, say, something with a Hellfire missile attached to it that's going to blow something up. We're going to be engaged in spying on other countries forever, and countries will be spying on us forever. That's never going to change. The real fear, or the real problem that I have and that a lot of people have is using armed drones on foreign powers with which we have no, either obviously not a declaration of war, but even any hint that we're engaged in kinetic operations on their soil. By using drones and by using technology like that, we remove the human element. War is a horrible thing, but there is some sort of redemptive value in having people on the ground doing that sort of thing. So when an American soldier dies, as a community and as a society and as a nation, we feel that loss, and that reflects in our military policy. And that's why you have something like the surge in Iraq, because there's a clear outcry. Something is not working, and we've got to fix it. With drone technology, you kind of remove that human aspect to it. Suddenly, it's a ghost war that we don't care about because our communities don't suffer as a result.
It's almost like the old argument between manned bombers and missiles. This is KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM, and you're listening to Open Journal, and my program is Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. My guest is D.B. Grady, and I have Manolo on the phone from Mission, Texas. Manolo, you're on the air.
Yes, Mike, thank you for taking my call. Just as a curiosity, I've always been really curious why it is that the United States just didn't destroy the drone that fell down in Iran.
Very good question.
I'll let my expert take it.
I'm sorry to jump in there. That's a good question. Immediately after the drone went down, the president had on his desk a plan from the Joint Special Operations Command to send in a team to blow it up. Now, before the Iranians found it, that's totally cool because we're just going to recover our equipment, we're going to blow it up, we're going to take it, we're going to do whatever to make sure that they don't get the technology. However, the minute the Iranians discovered the technology, in order for us to go there and blow up that technology, we would be, in a sense, it would be an act of war committed by the United States on the Iranians. Spying is not an act of war, but blowing something up, killing Iranian military, Iranian intelligence agencies, that is. So it was a very brief window of opportunity that we were going to take, but it simply didn't have time to materialize. But I mean, that's a good question. That's something we were going to do, and that's something that we wanted to do.
All right, Manolo, I appreciate your calling. I have Nick on the phone and want to get him before we run out of time. You're on the air, Nick. How you doing?
I'm fine. How about you?
Good, thank you. What do you got? What do you want to talk about?
My question is, you know, why can we, as a great superpower, you know, take care of Iran? You know, what is it that Iran wants that, you know, as a country we cannot, you know, handle it? Are we going to allow the Iranians to get the bomb before we, you know, we decide, you know, what is best in the safety, what is safe for the Middle East and for the world? Or we have to accommodate Iran as a nuclear power. That was my question to
I want David to answer, but I will comment that we have faced the same kind of question before when the Soviets were getting the bomb, when the Chinese were getting the bomb, when the Pakistanis were getting the bomb. David, what do you think is different, if there is anything different, about Iran getting the bomb potentially?
Well, obviously, Iran is a theocracy, and you would have, as Christopher Hitchens once said, a messianic apocalyptic cult with an apocalyptic weapon, and that's not the kind of thing that we really we really want to see. Now, there's nobody in the world, I think, that wants to see Iran get the bomb. No country in the Middle East wants Iran to get the bomb. No country in the Western Hemisphere wants Iran to get the bomb. And we're doing everything we can short of bombing them to stop that from happening.
And let's hope it gets to stay that way. Well, we are out of time for today. You've been listening to Open Journal, KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. I'm Mike Koenig. I call my show Think Wing Radio, and I hope it's been thought-provoking for you today. I'll look forward to chatting with you folks again. Have a great weekend, and remember, slower traffic, keep right. It's not just a good idea, it's the law. You've been listening to Open Journal, KPFT's experiment in community-inspired radio. Since 1970, KPFT has been a unique source on the Houston airwaves. Visit KPFT.org to support this station. KPFT listener members are welcome to produce an Open Journal. Prospective producers must fill out an Open Journal request form, which is available at our website. The program director welcomes your feedback on every Open Journal. Listener feedback helps KPFT determine what Open Journals are appreciated by the community at large. To get in touch with the program director, send an email to pd@kpft.org or call 713-526-4000, extension 308. Please stay tuned for Undercurrents coming up at 10, followed by Wide Open Spaces at 11. And thank you for tuning in today to Open Journal here on 90.1 KPFT Houston, Radio for Peace.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
Hello, drug policy aficionados. I'm Mary Jane Borden, editor of Drug War Facts. The question for this week asks, how many people are under the control of the U.S. criminal justice system? An April 2011 report by the Justice Policy Institute begins by stating, quote, the United States is the home to the world's largest prison population. The U.S. has only 5% of the world's population, but holds 25% of the world's prisoners, end quote. There are several components to the U.S. criminal justice system. Quoting the Institute, quote, the entry point into the criminal justice system is typically through law enforcement. In the U.S., when a person is charged with an offense, they may be detained in jail until their trial, or they may be released to await their trial in the community through a variety of mechanisms. People are said to be remanded, which is a summons to appear before a judge at a later date. If they are not released pre-trial, they can be remanded to custody until their court proceeding. If they are convicted, they can be remanded to custody prior to sentencing or during an appeal process. Pre-trial detention is associated with a higher likelihood of both being found guilty and receiving a sentence of incarceration over probation, thus forcing a person further into the criminal justice system. In the United States, this is particularly important because of the sheer numbers, end quote. What are those numbers? In 2010, there were 4 million people on probation, 800,000 on parole, 207,000 in federal prison, 1.3 million in state prison, and 749,000 in local jails, for a total of 7.1 million people under the control of the U.S. criminal justice system. These facts and others like them can be found in the Prisons and Jails chapter of Drug War Facts at www.drugwarfacts.org. If you have a question for which you need facts, please email it to me at mjborden@drugwarfacts.org. I'll try to answer your question in an upcoming show. So remember, when you need facts about drugs and drug policy, you can get the facts at Drug War Facts.
Folks, 2012 promises to be a banner year in changing these idiotic drug laws, and it'll work much better if you educate yourself, because with that education, you'll be emboldened to do your part to expose this madness of eternal war on each other for what we put into our own bodies.